Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your first time listening or you just recently found us, thanks so much for putting us in your ears. Get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com to let us know what you think about this episode or about anything you'd like us to cover in the future. We love hearing from you. Today, we are talking to a young Dublin writer about her new collection of short stories called Free Therapy. Sally Rooney is a big fan and so are we.
I think writers are strange. I think you have to be a bit strange as well, like a little bit, so not socially odd, but yeah, a bit socially odd, I suppose, because I think then you're kind of walking around with your skin inside out a little bit and you're a bit sensitive and you pick up on things. And I like when you're looking at something, whether it's in your own kind of social circles, with this, oh, there's a bit of friction there. What's happening there? Or you just pick up on things. And yeah, it's definitely part of it, 100%.
That was Rebecca Ivory there, and more from that talented woman very soon. First, just a reminder that our next Women's Podcast Book Club is coming up and we are reading The Amendments by Niamh Mulvey. It's out soon, so grab a copy if you can and read along with us. It's a book about mothers and daughters and the social fabric of life for women and girls in Ireland through the decades. That's The Amendments by Niamh Mulvey. Now, Rebecca Ivory is a 31-year-old Dubliner who has just published her first collection of short stories. Free Therapy takes us into the inner lives of women and men who are versed in the language of therapy, possessed with the self-knowledge needed to change their lives, but finding themselves unwilling to do so. As her characters try and fail to connect via sex, friendship, screens and work, Ivory explores desire in all its forms, revealing the ways in which we posture and present and the softness and insecurities that lie beneath all that posturing. These are stories about crap jobs and the desire not to go to them, crap men and the desire still to go to them, and worse than crap housing is another common theme that many will relate to. The Guardian, no less, says that it captures the experience of being a young woman today with a clear eye and a listless sigh. And Sally Rooney, as I mentioned, is also a fan, calling Ivory's collection arresting and inventive. But this is also a young woman who has experienced what she calls chronic embarrassment at the idea of being creative, so much so that she studied international relations at college instead of English, because although she'd been writing since she was a young girl, the idea of doing something creative for a living was mortifying. Thank goodness she has mostly gotten over that now, because her voice is compelling. We spoke about her working class background, her struggle to find the confidence to write and share her work, and her lifelong fascination with people of all ages and their interior lives. The book is called Free Therapy, as I said, and the author actually thanks her therapist in the acknowledgements. So I began by asking Rebecca Ivory just how crucial her own counsellor was in the process of writing the book.
Yeah, it's actually, I had therapy this morning.
We all need it.
Yeah. Oh, I will do it forever. Whether it's once a month or once a week, I will always do it. I hope with always my current therapist, Elaine, who I did ask her, I said, is it okay if I acknowledge you in the book? I think most people who have a therapist would be kind of conscious of trying to manage a boundary line. But yeah, of course, she was okay with it. Yeah, no, I think for me, the title is obviously Free Therapy. There's a story in the book called Free Therapy. The idea being, I suppose, more that you go through life and experiences and you can't have a game plan for things. You just have to find a way to manage. I don't think that's a novel idea. But I think for me, this thing of life and writing and therapy, they're very interconnected. I think what therapy does for me, in the same way that writing does it, is it slows life down a bit to the degree that you can kind of go, what's happening here? What am I feeling? What are they feeling? Whose fault is it or whose fault isn't it? And it's the same in writing. So I think that the three things are very related for me anyway. And it's the same when I'm taught, like I love listening to people. I love listening to people talk about their lives and their problems that they're having. And I love getting into the nitty gritty. So I think it's very, I think they're very complementary to each other to be a writer and to be interested in therapy, your own feelings. And I'm going to say, people are going to hate me for saying that. People don't like people to be interested in their own feelings. But I think, you know,
self-indulgent
being interested,
millennial you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm embracing it. At least I'm not Gen Z.
Oh, sorry,
I've had that leveled at me before that I'm Gen Z, but I'm 31, so I'm a millennial. But and yeah, I think, yeah.
Free therapy, the story is about a young woman who sort of joins a woman's group with women who are kind of a bit older than her. And that's something that happened to you. You did find yourself in your late teens joining a kind of a therapy group with women older. So what did you get from that and how did that inform and inspire that story?
Yeah, it was very funny. I think I've talked about it before, but I mean, like joining at that, I think I was 19 when I joined. And I think most 19-year-olds feel pretty self-conscious and insecure. And most 19-year-olds probably think they're the only person to feel that way. Most writers feel self-conscious. So I think it wasn't exclusive to women, although that was a kind of a nice way to write about it in the story. But yeah, I think for me, my experience of it was, I think my primary emotion is embarrassment. So I can't help but feel just huge embarrassment. It was brilliant in terms of helping me have coping skills for life and going through your 20s and having these different relationships and going through lots of different jobs and figuring out that, you know, it's not that you're crap at everything, you're just human. And I think that's a skill we probably all need to learn. But mostly I feel, at times I feel embarrassed because I think about, you know, being around people who are a lot older than me, or not a lot older, but they're in their 30s and 40s and kind of feeling like I had to have an answer in terms of feedback for them and giving them feedback about their lives. I mean, I actually think it was really, really gracious of them to accept that. I don't know, as someone now who, you know, still has an awful lot to learn, obviously, but I don't know if I could take feedback from an 18-year-old now. I think I'd probably find that really grating. So it was brilliant. And I had relationships with people that I probably wouldn't have otherwise and a support system that I wouldn't have otherwise. But yeah, I do kind of go, oh God, was I just really, really precocious? So that's kind of the abiding memory as well.
I mean, I'm interested in you talking about how you love listening to people. And I'm sure when you were in that group therapy situation, it must have been fascinating for you as a burgeoning writer. Were you writing at that stage? Did you start quite early?
I think, yeah, I think I always wrote. I never really expressed an interest in wanting to write. To me, that was really, again, embarrassing. I know it's awful to say, but I was just incredibly embarrassed by this creative desire. And I think, like, I loved listening to people then, but I would listen to anybody, especially I think Irish people have such a lovely way of speaking. There's such a, I don't know, it'll still happen where I might just catch a snippet of a conversation and it's like a ball of thread. There's a thread of conversation and then it kind of, you start to unravel it and you go off on your own tangent. So that's a lot of the time where a story might come from. But I think, yeah, I think I did always write. And I think initially, I think I wanted to be a journalist because I thought that would be and I know this is probably common, but I thought I had come up with this, that it was a way to write without kind of taking a risk of seeming like I wanted to be creative. To me, there was nothing more embarrassing than wanting to be creative. And that's what I've become.
you had to lean into it eventually.
Yeah.
There's a really good story in the book. I think it's work and charity. And the young woman is working in a newspaper. So I presume your experiences in the Daily Mail for a few months might have inspired that.
Absolutely, it did. There was a friend of mine, now she didn't have to do it in the end, but we both started, and she's still a journalist now, she's a great journalist, but she was going to be sent on an assignment as a kind of this undercover thing to go out, and it stayed with me for such a long time because I mean we just got such crack out of the idea of it, maybe this may be happening. And then that's kind of where the story came from, was like, what would it be like if she actually did go and do this? Now she actually would have been well able for it, but the character in the book, obviously it's a very destabilizing experience. It causes her to kind of question all of her career choices and life choices, really.
She goes undercover as a chugger, which is a very, very good idea for a story. And it's what and it's the people she meets through that. And kind of there's a lot of toxic sex and relationships in that's one of the themes, I think, in the book. And I suppose as a young woman, as you said, a 31, still a millennial, not a Gen Z, it must have been interesting to explore all of that, because I think that's a feature definitely of maybe younger Irish women writers. They don't have so much baggage around sex and expressing all of that stuff, which I think is why I love reading younger writers now. At the moment, it's so exciting. Did you feel like you can be more expressive about that than perhaps in, you know, women who have older generations who maybe it was a different kind of writing? Not that they weren't brave enough to explore them, but I think younger writers go there much more now.
Yeah, I think, look, I listened to Cathy Sweeney talk about this on your podcast before, and I love her writing. I haven't read Breakdown yet, and I'm looking forward to it.
I loved
her collection. It's incredible. Her collection is incredible, but she's an amazing writer. But I think what she said, and I think other writers have said it as well, is write it like no one's going to read it is the only way you can write anything. If there's any self-consciousness in it whatsoever, it will never be written in the quality that you kind of intended to. And I don't think the energy or spirit will be in it. So I think that was the approach I took. And I didn't think anyone was going to read this. Like, I really didn't. I did have a lot of shame. Like, the stuff I was writing, I kind of went, like, there was a period of time where I would write things by hand, and then it would kind of be hidden in the sock drawer for a while. And then eventually I'd tear it up and it would just go in the bin. So, like, there wasn't really a bank of drafts on my laptop. It was a lot more secretive than that. Writing about sex and stuff like that, or things that maybe you might find, certainly among me and my friends, we're not people who talk about in too great detail of it. So I don't think that even women my age are always very open about it. Certainly not with your school friends, say. I think there's something about people you went to school with and you were part of a certain era or time where it was still probably quite shameful for women to think about sex in a way that isn't just, you know, that you're an object of desire, that you might have your own desires and they can be embarrassing. I think with new friends, it's easier because you're meeting them as an adult. But yeah, I was very, when I found out the book was going to be published, I could feel myself go, I wonder, can I just take those things back? Can I adjust it slightly? And you can't, because those are things that make it what
yeah,
they are.
Absolutely, yeah. Rebecca, because I'm thinking of, I think it's from again, Work and Charity, where she does end up going home with this chugger, this fellow chugger, and having sex with him. And I was really imagining, I live in the North Strand and it actually all happens in the North Strand. So it's kind of, I can visualise it very well. But he, at one point he puts his hands around her neck and tries to choke her, and he says, "What? I thought girls liked that." And I think that's very telling about the kind of experiences that young women, particularly that I've spoken to, are having at the moment, where this is seen because of the influence of porn as something that's very normal, and young guys are thinking, "Oh, this is what you're supposed to do," when actually it's not really what necessarily young women want.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think in that situation, like, I didn't really write that guy as a, I don't think I write or set out to write anybody ever as a villain. I only ever write them as like another human being. And I think it's, the roles were switched and I had been writing his perspective, maybe you could have slightly more empathy for him. But I don't think I'm able to write from that perspective quite as much. I'm able to write older men, but younger men I struggle with for some reason. But yeah, I definitely think it's, everyone is a victim of this culture. Like, I don't think it's only for young women or women in general. I think it's, everyone is a victim of this in a way, or that kind of has fallen prey to it in some way or another. And he is trying to kind of connect with her. Like, I don't think there's any part of him that thinks this is just a kind of an animalistic thing. Like, he really does want to connect with her. And so in a way, well, he maybe is doing things that might seem, you know, they're dehumanizing to her a little bit. I think that is also going on from her end to him, and that's just having relationships, I think, you know, at any point in history.
Yeah, I'm interested in how you go from the sort of shame and embarrassment of your creativity with the stuff being just shoved in your sock drawer or wherever, to kind of making the step to getting published, because it, also in your acknowledgements, you had a very lovely moment. And I think I love your honesty where you say that you cried when Sally Rooney accepted your story for the Stinging Fly Literary Journal, which I could totally understand. I would be that person myself, definitely crying if I got such an email. Tell me about that, about like kind of what it meant when you got sort of validation.
Oh, it was just, I still think of that, like those couple of years at the time. So you're saying you live around the North Strand. I spent a lot of my early 20s there. It's my favourite place,
I think,
in the world. I love Dublin 3. I love that area. At the time, I was living in my granny had passed away and I was living in her house in Marino. I was like, this was a kind of slightly different time where living in Dublin was a little bit easier, you know. But I had it super easy because I lived in like a house that my family owned before they sold it. And I was just so happy because all I had to do was go to my job and write in the mornings and see my friends in the evening. It was the happiest time of my life. So I kind of just felt like if I get to do this and whatever happens, it'll be okay. This was really, it was kind of the first time in my life I felt like myself. I was kind of, an adult for the first time, the way I felt. So then when I was in my job, I worked in, I worked for Fingal County Council at the time. And I remember getting the email saying that the story had been accepted. And like, it's a bit embarrassing as well, because I really thought I'd made it. Like I was like, I can quit my job. You know, like I kind of had this kind of thing going on. I still haven't quit my job. Do you know what I mean? But I don't work there anymore. But like, it was really funny. Like it meant so much to me. Like I did go to the bathroom and I did cry, and it was real excitement and validation, but also a feeling of like, it was the first time I felt as though something I was doing was aligned with me. And I just thought, like, if I can just do this, like, I'll be really happy. And yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you feel the same with me, like, about first reading Sally Rooney, because I had an absolutely sort of out-of-body experience almost reading Conversation with a Friend. I had a proof of it for the first time. And I remember sitting down and reading it and just not knowing anything. This is before nobody knew the name Sally Rooney, and just going, who is this who has written this? And you have a very different voice. It's not the same voice or anything like that. But do you feel like Sally Rooney has had an impact on young women, in terms of young women who wanting to be writers, to not giving permission, obviously, because, you know, you're writing anyway, but how much did she influence you in terms of just seeing her, seeing what she was doing, the kind of originality of her work and all of that?
Hugely. I actually remember at that time, like, I heard Sally doing an interview on the radio, and I remember just being, feeling really excited. I remember feeling like something was happening at the time, and it felt like being alive during a change in the way art was made. And I'm not qualified at all to talk about that in any serious way, but that was my feeling at the time. And then personally for me, the thing that really solidified it was Normal People. I loved Conversations with Friends, but for me, Normal People was this thing of kind of taking Irish people and the way Irish people talked and the way they conducted themselves and making it something, you know. And there's lots of Irish writers doing this. I'm not saying it's just Sally, but I think as a young woman,
yes,
watching someone do that who could possibly be a peer who's the same age, and making these lives really worth investigating. And I feel the same about people's lives, is that they are, no matter who they are, there's no such thing as a dull inner life. And to see someone else do that, it wasn't the feeling I had from it. There was no, and I mean this genuinely, there was zero envy or jealousy. It was just kind of,
Yeah.
It's just like, this is really cool. And it's really cool to be alive and kind of coming of age for it.
I totally understand that. And yeah. I felt the same myself. I was just really felt, oh my God, I'm so glad I'm getting to read this person. I'm so happy that this person's in the world. And that's the way, I'm so excited about her next novel. And I loved Beautiful World, Where Are You as well. So okay, I think we've established we're both super fans of Sally.
Yeah.
But talk to me about your own influences, because it sounds like, would you say a working class background you come from?
Yes, I think, and sometimes I'm a bit worried about saying this in case people criticize me for it, because I've been college educated, but I'm the first person on either side of my family that was that went to kind of formal third level education. My parents are from two working class families. My mom grew up in Ballybock in Dublin and my dad grew up in Marino. So very close by. They got married quite young, bought a house out in Ashburn. But they, it's really funny because I think, I don't think either of them have read the book and I don't think they will, which is, they're very, very supportive. But, and I think they're kind of doing that nearly out of respect for me. But I think they're huge influences. My mom's side of the family, I will say, I think when I was, before I went to primary school, I never went to play school or anything like that. I was sent into my nan's to be minded by her while my mom worked. My mom worked as a receptionist in Temple Street Hospital for years and years and years. So that was kind of the daily routine. And I was exposed an awful lot to, so my nan and her friends, and every day walking into town, and just, she's such, I can't even do her justice. She should have been a writer and my mother should have been a writer. And there's a bit of, and maybe they don't feel this way, maybe this is me kind of projecting, but I feel a bit sad for them that they don't, because I kind of think, God, like the world really is missing out. Because I think my nan in particular, like my mom has the same voice and she's certainly becoming more and more like her, but she's so funny, my nan, the way she tells stories, it's so dramatic and there's this great comedic timing without her intending it at all. And we're all just used to it because we're around it so frequently, but certainly as I think a 4 year old, being around her was just being exposed to that. I think it rewired my brain at that age a little bit and planted a little seed that eventually made me into a writer. Yeah,
I'm fascinated that they won't read it, and actually in your acknowledgements again you say I hope they won't read it.
Yeah, so maybe, I don't want them to read about the weird sex.
Maybe you'll have this nice sort of thing where they'll just be really proud of you, but they won't be that interested, and you won't mind, you won't be offended that they're not interested, and it'll be all cool.
I think like, for my dad doesn't read, he would say I can't read. Now he can, obviously he's literate, but he actually can't sit down to read anything, which is fine. My mom does read, but she reads very different. I actually don't think, she'll kill me for saying this, sorry mom, but I actually don't think she would like the book in a way. Like, I don't think it's something she'd enjoy. I think she's incredibly proud of me and incredibly supportive, but she just has different tastes.
And
you
that's
know what
fine.
I mean? And yeah, which is totally grand.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now let's talk about some of the other stories, because I, as someone who is lucky enough never to have to go on a single internet date because of my age, I was really fascinated by Tiny Wrestler, which is about a young woman who meets someone on Tinder and goes and has, again, not very satisfying, but not, you know, evil sex or anything like that. Just pretty ordinary,
evil
I'd say.
Evil sex. I'm very interested in evil sex.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's just what you were saying, that you don't try and make anyone a villain. Like,
no,
it's
totally,
not the,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
that there's any sexual assault going on, but it's not very satisfying from the young woman's perspective, let's say.
Mm.
But tell me about that side of things, because I presume as a 31-year-old, that is something that you've experienced and had to endure. And I'm sure it's inspired some of the stories.
Ah, absolutely. I mean, like, oh, Jesus, we've all, like, I think most people my age who haven't just been in a relationship since secondary school, do you know, like, we were kind of around for the dawn of internet dating. I met my boyfriend now, we're together 6 years, and we met on Tinder. Do you know what I mean? So like, you can obviously go really well, and it's just like the way of the world. But how did it? I don't want to lie. I definitely had experiences that gave me ideas for the story. And what I think in my real life, I definitely made them out to be villains with my friends. And it's kind of only in, I think it's really easy through things like dating apps to write people off, even if they mistreat you. I think it's really easy to write people off as being like with extremities, like using extreme language. Like now I think it's probably not so much maybe when I was dating, but like this thing of calling people narcissists or toxic. And I don't think that's what me and my friends were doing when I was kind of chatting about the dates I'd been on, but I definitely would have been labeling them as bad guys, you know, whereas I think in reality, like, they probably just didn't like me very much, you know what I mean? And like a bit like my mom not liking the world, like, that's not a moral failing. I'd been ghosted kind of, or someone tried to ghost me and I wouldn't let them. just let them. Like, why do you need, like, I think what I've done a couple of times is force someone to tell me they don't like me. Like, there was one guy I'd been dating who I actually didn't meet through a dating app. A mutual friend set us up, and I thought that kind of guaranteed success, because I kind of thought he wouldn't mistreat someone who kind of was friends with his friends. And he didn't mistreat me. He was just, I think he was trying to let it fade out, and I was like, oh God, I'm mortified. I wouldn't let it go. I don't know why. I was just like, no, I'm going to make you tell me that you don't like me. And it turns out that he was actually he'd met someone else who he preferred, and he was honest with me. And I did this thing where I was like, oh, I don't know why I did this, but I was like, but you know, tell me why you prefer her, which is just like, it's not fair on anybody. And he had to tell me the reasons why he preferred her. And ugh. I think I could be wrong. I think one of the reasons was that she made him feel more exciting.
And
I actually do think that's probably fair feedback, because I think at the time he'd asked me to do like indoor rock climbing, and I was absolutely like, no way, I'm sorry, I can't. So I think that's maybe she did the indoor rock climbing.
Maybe she did that and it was more exciting. But I think that's what makes your writing so brilliant, because it's that kind of ability to go right in there into those cringy moments in your life that you're obviously have a tendency to do. And you do that in the writing as well. You don't shy away from those maybe excruciating moments, which there's a lot of in the book.
And in life.
Yes.
I think, I think it's the only way for someone who is so embarrassed. I have kind of I think I have an interesting relationship with embarrassment, where I can't tolerate it almost, but I'm obsessed with it, and then I will talk about it so much. I pick and pick and pick at it and overshare it with people. And it's like the only way to take the sting out of it is to talk about it like wide, and, you know, to tell everybody, basically.
I get that. I should also say that not all the stories are about younger people, because you actually write older people very well too. There's a couple of stories, and they also sort of explore a bit of about class as well. I'm trying to think of the name of the one now, which with Greg and Jamie.
Oh, it's Lines to Keep.
Lines to Keep.
Yes.
Where it's this sort of single father. He's in his 60s and he's living alone with his daughter, who's trying to get through college and working. And it's a very well drawn story about a kind of, you know, a situation where the mother had mental illness and is gone from the scene. And are you particularly interested as well in older people and just in relationships? And you know, you don't seem to be just the preserve of young people and what was going on with your generation.
Yeah, I think I'm very interested in older people, because I really like to hear about their life experiences. Like, I think, again, it probably comes back a little bit to I enjoy listening to people. And I don't think young people are as free with information about their lives as older people are. I think that's probably contradictory in a way, because we have an idea of young people sharing everything online. But I think I'm not the first person to say this, obviously what is shared is, it's kind of, there's a veneer on it. Even vulnerable stuff sometimes I think is shared in a way that is designed for engagement. But with older people, I don't think there's that same veneer. I think there is actually a guilelessness about it, where they don't care. They're just, they really have gotten to a point. God, I'm making them sound like aliens. Like, I'm sure there's probably people, older people, they're like, gosh, Jesus, she's never met an older person
in her
life. No,
I get what you mean. There's a certain thing about aging where you kind of, you stop caring so much and you're not so, self-conscious and all of that. And kind of, it becomes less of a big deal to maybe just talk about your life as it's been.
Absolutely. And I think there's, with older people, they're much more willing to tell you maybe secrets. I don't mean, and sometimes I think I've made that about me where I've gone, I'm very trustworthy. But actually, when I think about it, it's just them. They just don't care. Yeah. And I think that's great.
There's another story called The Slip about Colm and Norma. And Colm kind of loses it one day on his way to work. He's had a few things going on. His 16-year-old cat Pogo has died and his father also died. But the cat seemed to have got to him more than the father dying. And he also has had some, you know, medical injuries as well. But I just, it's a really interesting story because of a portrait of a marriage. Like, again, with short stories, what I find wonderful in what you do is how much you get into these brief enough kind of pages and telling whole lives. Is that something that you've kind of appreciated about the short story form?
Yeah, I thank you. That's lovely to hear. I think the way short stories are told, and I'm not saying that, you know, it takes a certain person to write them, because obviously I'm trying to write a novel now, but I think the way you write a short story depends on how you're, the way you think and the way your thinking is kind of wired. Sometimes with a short story, it doesn't work. And for some reason with this one, I was just able to drop myself in and kind of write it as if I know and the reader knows. They don't need to know too much about these people. I can give them a background in a sentence or two and people will just know, probably because it's similar to their own lives or their parents' lives. And I think that's what it was in with this story, was we were just meeting them on one day. It was like over the course of a day, and it was kind of a pivotal moment for them because it was an opportunity for this couple to connect and support each other in a way that they don't do in a daily way. They really get at each other. They don't sleep in the same bed, which doesn't necessarily mean they're not in love, although I would say they're not totally in love, but it's not like, you know, people don't sleep in the same bed for lots of different reasons, for practical reasons. And I think for this guy, it's like, this has happened on a day he's snapped and he just has lost composure completely. And I think there's a real kind of humility and grace in the way that she handles it. And I don't think she's, maybe not everyone would read her and like her, but I think that's part of being married to someone for a long time, is you know them inside out, and maybe sometimes realizing it doesn't serve you or them to kind of hold them, you know, hold their feet to the fire too much. What I like about long marriages and people who've stayed together a long time is there's a lot you just let go of and a lot you don't need to talk about in a productive way. Like, I like that we can forgive each other in life.
Really beautifully said. And I think that's why I think your writing shows a real maturity that I was surprised by, because obviously I'd expect that you'd be able to do those insights with the younger people your own age. But when I see how well drawn the older characters are and the interior lives of those characters, I feel like, you know, there's a bit of a master at work. And I don't say that lightly, because I really, really enjoyed the book so much. And just talk to me about living in Alberta, Canada, because you were living there when Corona happened. You were waitressing and writing at the same time. Do you think why did you go to Alberta, first of all? And do you think you'd still be there if the coronavirus hadn't come?
I went because my boyfriend wanted to go, and I would have, so in love with him, I would have followed him absolutely anywhere. I had no sense of self whatsoever. I was just blindly going where he wanted to go. And I did want to travel as well. I was kind of, you know, we were both like, I think I was 26 when I went over there. So it was just the year before COVID hit that we landed there. I don't think we'd still be there. I think we went to Calgary, which is a strange city that seems, I don't know, I'm no expert, I got the impression it was built for the purpose of kind of oil and gas men to kind of live there and work in oil and gas. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But I, and it definitely felt that way. It felt very odd to go from Dublin, where I think people talk about this great culture of art and literature, and I didn't recognise how great it is until I went to a place that didn't have it quite so much. There were things, like there was culture, but it's very different. And I actually felt a bit heartsick for Dublin when I was there. I struggled hugely being away from home. I was so homesick. And as someone who's used to growing up relatively close to the coast, this is going to sound like I'm, you know, excessively kind of spiritual. Really missed being near the coast. I really missed the sea. I actually think it made me feel a bit sick. My bones didn't feel right. It was very isolated. It was very beautiful. And I didn't have any friends. Not having friends is really hard. We just had each other. We were only going out a year and a half, and we were kind of thrown into this where we only had each other, which was tough, but it was great for writing.
Yeah,
I got loads of writing done.
And you got a story set in Alberta as well.
Yes, one
of
the stories. Yeah, the last story. And it's the last story for a reason, because I think that's a person in that story who's just so disjointed. They work in a restaurant. I worked for a restaurant for a time over there, but I didn't have an affair with a 20-year-old as she does in the story. She's a, you know, kind of in her early 30s, and she's working in a restaurant after having worked in loads of different odd jobs. I think there's like it's really fun to write about demoralizing work. No interest in writing about someone who likes their career. I couldn't care less about that. And she kind of enters into this strange situationship, as they say, with a 20-year-old who has a girlfriend who also works in the restaurant. And all these people are younger than her, and they all have more power than her and more social power than her. And she's strange, and she knows that she's strange, and she's also very poor. She doesn't have any money, but she's, I think that's kind of a story, maybe a little bit about social mobility and being able to progress beyond the means of your parents a little bit, and her unwillingness to do that. She doesn't seem capable of it. She could do it, so it's not like she's helpless. And I think by the end of the story, she's fundamentally the same, but she's managing to kind of build a bit of a life for herself over there. Mm. I'm not giving anything away. My stories don't really have a plot, so.
No, you're not. And I should mention as well the opening story, which is about two friends, one who are kind of competing with each other in terms of their body shape and trying to lose weight. Mm. And it's a really powerful opening story. So there's a lot about friendship, I think, in the book as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot about female friendship and kind of how covertly destructive it can be, and how women aren't really allowed to be. I think we have this thing of like, I don't like it in life and I don't like it in writing, of there's a way that you're supposed to be. I think it's really limiting in both writing and in life. And I think maybe when people read about the women who are either friends or just, you know, the women in the stories, whatever, there's this thing of like them being unlikable. And I think that's really, it makes me feel really lonely when someone says that, actually. Do you know, like when people are like, they're really unlikable, or it's a dark story kind of, because it just makes me go like, oh, we're going to pretend no one feels this way. Okay. And I think that's, yeah, I prefer to read about people that make me kind of maybe feel a little bit better about my own shortcomings as well.
Yeah, it's funny. A friend of mine was enjoying Kathy Sweeney's breakdown, but was saying to me she just couldn't warm to the woman. And I was trying to say, who cares? She's amazing. Yeah. She's such a great character. You don't have to like her. But there is a sort of pressure, and there is some kind of people, some readers want to like the protagonist, don't they? Mm-hmm. They want to feel an affinity and they want to root for them. But life's more complex than that. I think people are more complex.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, I'd say, I mean, if you think about like if there's someone in your life, I don't know, like someone you feel competitive with, I think if you were to read a story about their day, you'd have a bit of sympathy for them, even if they're really unlikable. I think you'd still go, oh God, like there's, you know, like that's a difficult challenge they're after facing there. But, you know, I suppose apart from friends, I think that mothers loom pretty large in it too. And I think mothers and daughters can have really interesting friendships and relationships. Mm. And I think a lot of the people in these stories, whether their mother is absent or present, there's a lot of trying to kind of get away from the mother and then returning. And that wasn't really conscious, I don't think. I think it's just part of being a writer.
Yeah. You mentioned that you haven't given up the day job yet. I predict that you will be able to and commit yourself full time to writing. That's just said it here on the Women's Podcast, because I think you're such a talent. So what are you doing at the moment then? You're working and writing?
working and writing the next novel, I don't mind if I don't have to give up work. I think work is a good, don't want my employers to think I can stealing stories. I'm actually starting a new job next week. So I did work at the Irish Cancer Society, a place I loved. It's a really lovely place to work. I won't mention my new employer just yet, just in case. But I know I don't mind having a day job. I'm not always that, I don't talk about writing that much in life. And it's handy to have something to say to taxi drivers or, you know, hairdressers going, what do you do? Rather than be like, I'm a writer. I just say, oh, I do this, work and blah, blah, blah.
So you can hide behind your day job?
Yeah, a little bit.
And save yourself the embarrassment of being a creative person. Oh,
completely, yeah, absolutely. Always working on
the identity. I wonder will that
ever
leave you?
I don't know. I think I love talking about writing. I really enjoy it, but I love it as being as a kind of a conversation. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is so lovely because I know I'm talking to someone who loves books as well. But I think I have found this experience, while I'm incredibly grateful, destabilizing too. I'm very self-conscious at the moment and probably being self-critical. And that will pass as this all levels out. But it's an odd experience for someone who is chronically embarrassed.
And I think it will pass, but also in a way it won't pass. And that's part of the gift that you have as a writer. And you said it very early on about writers being self-conscious. I think there's a part of that has to be there in order for you to do what you do.
Yeah, I think so. I think writers are strange. I think you have to be a bit strange as well, like a little bit, so not socially odd, but yeah, a bit socially odd, I suppose, because I think then you're kind of walking around with your skin inside out a little bit and you're a bit sensitive and you pick up on things. And I like when you're looking at something, whether it's in your own kind of social circles, with this, oh, there's a bit of friction there. What's happening there? Or you just pick up on things. And yeah, it's definitely part of it, 100%.
Well, before you go, tell us about the novel and how you're finding the switch from these short stories, which you've done so brilliantly, to a longer form. How are you finding that challenge?
It is challenging. It's difficult at the moment to organise my thoughts. That's where with a novel, when I'm looking at it now, it doesn't feel all that cohesive. And it is a story about a marriage, as I said, like these people who persevere through a marriage when, you know, maybe just looking from the outside, they shouldn't, but they do, as well as their relationship with their adult daughter and her half sibling. So there is also, you know, there was an extramarital affair and how they kind of cope with that. But I think that the difference is just time. I think when you're writing a novel, you need to dive in a little bit more. And I think I've been through kind of, you know, working, I can work and write, but I don't think I can work, write and promote the first book and have my brain be in two different books, you know. So I think I'll find it a little bit easier to write this novel or to do the second draft or whatever when I'm a bit more fully in it. At the moment, I'm kind of cheating on the two books.
Well, I'm dying to read your novel, so hurry up and write it and get yourself organised in your thoughts or whatever it needs to have, if that's any motivation. But like, it is difficult when you're promoting something as well and your head is in, you know, your head has to be in the short stories because you're going to be talking about them all the time. So maybe just give yourself a little break for a while until...
Yeah, I have a few days off now and I'm kind of going to get over this chesty flu cough thing. So yeah, I'll have a few days off to chill for sure.
Yeah, well, it's been absolutely lovely speaking to you. And I really enjoy talking to people whose books I've enjoyed because it's great to get the insight into where they're coming from. And you've had an interesting life and you're coming from an interesting background too, which I think a lot of times we, especially these days, we're maybe thinking of people coming from more privileged backgrounds and stuff. And that certainly has one perspective, but a writer who comes from maybe a different background can offer more and maybe richer texture to the writing as well. And I really love that about your book. And I've recommended it to loads of people. So hopefully I can influence some sales and with this podcast.
Thank you.
As well.
Hopefully. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming on the Women's Podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much, Roisin.
That was Rebecca Ivory there, and her brilliant book is called Free Therapy. If you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe, as it really makes a difference to us. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us on thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I will talk to you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.